This is day two of the 2006 Idyllwild Bible School. Our third period teacher is Brother James Mansfield. His general topic is those who overcame. Today's topic is Judah. Brother James?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Beautiful. We want to start in Genesis chapter 30 and at verse 22. After a long period of time, in Genesis chapter 30 and at verse 22, Rachel finally conceives and has Joseph. The character that we're going to look at this morning is Judah. And you sometimes wonder, well, when Joseph was born, how old was Judah? And the answer to that question is approximately 21 years old. The great tragedy is that for the formative years of his life, they were spent in a house filled with conflict, with problems, with competition, and vindictiveness. And unfortunately, it had a very bad effect upon the boys, as we're going to see later on. You can imagine when Joseph was finally born, an incredible fuss would have been made over this boy by both his father and his mother, and the rest of the brothers, who are by now grown men, reacted very, very badly. At first, they disliked this little boy. They hated the favoritism that had been shown to him, and it ended up where they absolutely hated their brother Joseph. So basically what we're going to do this morning, we're going to look at the problems of Judah. That'll be the first half, and we're going to see just how many problems he had. And then we're going to see what God did to change perhaps one of the worst characters that we're going to look at this week. There's the first problem, a problem of envy and jealousy. Now come across to chapter 34. In chapter 34, we know the story, so we can go through this quite quickly. Dinah, his full sister, is raped. And the brothers all come up with a scheme of revenge. And what do? They use circumcision. They get these men of Shechem to be circumcised. One of the most wonderful principles of the truth, as they knew, one of the things that distinguished them from everyone else, they used this to support trickery and murder. And you might say in verse 25 of chapter 34 that it's just Simeon and Levi who are involved in this particular incident. But no, they're all involved, including Judah, because in verse 27 it says, "The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the cities because they had defiled their sister." And there is the fury of Jacob as he stands Simeon and Levi up in verse 30 and says, "You've made me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. I'm few in number, and they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me. I will be destroyed, I and my house." Now there's something else that occurred that had quite a lot to do with Judah. The next chapter, chapter 35 and at verse 22, when Israel dwelt in the land, Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi are in disgrace. They are the three oldest brothers, and there's no way they are going to get the birthright. Who's next in line? Reuben's out, Simeon's out, Levi's out, and the next one in line is Judah. And I think after this incident, he's starting to think, well, perhaps I might get the position and the power of the firstborn, and more importantly, the double inheritance. But when we come across to chapter 37, it's very obvious that's not going to happen. In chapter 37 and at verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all of his children. It's obvious he's going to get the position of the firstborn. He's going to get the double inheritance, and that is obvious when his father makes him a coat of many colours. Why? Why did his father love him more than all his brethren? And we know the answer, of course, he is the son of the beloved Rachel. But more than that, it's obvious he was a boy of incredible spirituality. He was the one who really should have been the spiritual leader in the house. And what happens? Verse 4, when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all their brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. What's the word peaceably in the Hebrew here? Shalom. When you go to Israel, everyone says shalom. You see your girlfriend, shalom. You see your best friend, shalom. You even see your enemy, shalom. But they hated Joseph so much, they couldn't even say shalom to him. And it got worse when Joseph dreams two dreams. The first one, in verse 7 and 8, is where his brethren bow down before him. But then in verse 10, the second dream has his father and his mother and his brothers, in verse 10, bowing before him. Where's his mother? So how on earth can verse 10 be fulfilled? Exactly. It is obviously talking about the kingdom. Can you see what this young boy, about 17-year-old, is doing? He can see the wickedness of his brethren, but he's giving them a dream. And what's he doing with this dream? He's encouraging them to see themselves in the kingdom despite your problems. He's saying our God is a God of grace, and he can change you and can prepare you for the kingdom. But the brothers said, no, he's simply a troublemaker. We want to kill him. And it comes to a head, as we all know the story, and that's the good thing. We can go through this very quickly. We can just concentrate on Judah. It comes to a head when he goes to his brethren in Dothan. They can see him miles away. And in verse 18, they say, let's kill him. Let's kill the, as the margin says, dream master. They had a nickname for him. Let's kill the dream master. And they encourage each other in verse 20, let's kill him and cast him into a pit. And we'll say to Dad, an evil beast has devoured him. And we will see what will become of him. This is worth circling, his dreams. I hate his dreams. And the only way to stop him is to kill him. Now we need to stop and think, what's going on here? Judah is a 40-year-old man. Joseph is only 17. Why are they so worried about this boy's dreams? I tell you what, if I went to a family gathering and my younger brother said, look, everyone, I've had a dream, and my dream is that I'll become the president of America, I wouldn't be upset. I wouldn't be envious. I'd think, terrific. I'll be able to stir my little brother for the next, I'll get at least 5 years out of this. It wouldn't upset any of you. Why were the brethren so upset with the dreams of Joseph?
They were conservative.
Yes? Why else? How does Joseph's dream compare to the imaginary dreams of my younger brother? The answer's obvious. They're real. Can you believe that? They hated Joseph so much that they knew that it was the will of God that Joseph would reign over them, and they said, if that's God's will, we don't want a part of it. We hate Joseph so much we are prepared to kill him so that God's will not be fulfilled. That shows how bad these boys have got. The third point, they'll do anything to go against God's will. And if it's God's will that Joseph rules over us, we're going to kill him. And it came to pass in verse 23, when Joseph came upon his brethren, they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colours. And see the focus. They hated the fact, A, he was a dreamer, but B, because he had this coat. And what happens is when Joseph comes into their midst and says shalom to them, 10 big, burly, grown-up men just absolutely attack him and just rip his coat apart. I might say, hang on, how do you know that? How do I know that? How do I know that when they took the coat off, they ripped it apart? Because later on, they simply get that coat and dip it in blood and take it to their father, and their father says, wild animals has torn him apart. It wasn't wild animals. It was his brethren as they tried to get the coat off their brother. And they threw him into a pit. Now, a pit is a cistern. A cistern that holds water, and apparently the average size cistern is 6 metres. 20 foot. Now, can you imagine that? You are dropped 20 foot. That's enough to break bones. There's Joseph lying at the bottom of this pit, undoubtedly winded, in a lot of pain. And then he realises that the sides of this cistern are smooth. There's no way he can get out, and he starts to plead for his life. And his brothers sat down to eat bread. Not only is he a murderer, he is a murderer who has no pity. And then as they're sitting there, eating their lunch, they see a caravan of Ishmaelites. And what happens? Verse 26, it is Judah. That's worth underlining. Judah says to his brethren, what profit is there if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Here's the fifth problem. Like Uncle Laban, he loves money. Come, he's a hypocrite. Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. We can't kill him. But it's all right to sell him into slavery. He's our brother and our flesh. We can't kill him, but it's all right to sell him into the hand of the Ishmaelites. Now, verse 26 and verse 27 are interesting because it shows the family dynamics. Verse 26, and Judah said, it appears he's the one that takes the lead, but at the end of verse 27, and his brethren were content. And the word content, according to Strong's, means they listened intelligently. So it seems to be indicating always Judah is the one taking the lead in the family, and the brethren were content to listen intelligently. And in the end, they agree to their price of 20 shekels. Judah was obsessed with money, but he accepted 20 shekels when he knew full well that the average price for a slave was 30 pieces of silver. Exodus 21 and verse 32 tells us that. Here's someone who loved money. He's prepared to lose 10 shekels on the deal, which was a lot of money. Such was his hatred. And they seemed taken away, and not one of the brothers, and particularly Judah, not one of them had pity or any misgivings. In actual fact, they felt an enormous sense of relief. No more coat, no more dreams. And we know the story in verse 31. They take the coat, they dip it in the kid of the bloods, and take it to their father. And notice what they say. At the end of verse 32, we don't know whether or not it is our brother's coat. No, we don't know if it is your son's coat. And verse 33, Jacob knew it. Strong's translates that. He scrutinized it carefully and he says, it's Joseph. A wild beast has killed him. He's been ripped to pieces. And then in verse 34, Judah has got to see the reaction of his father. He goes white. He almost has a heart attack. And then all the grief and the heartbreak of the last few years come pouring out, and he cannot stop crying all day, all night, all week, all month after month after month. And can you believe in verse 35, Judah tried to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. What a hypocrite. He pretends, your dad, I'm so sorry, I feel for you, when he knew all along that his brother wasn't dead. Why couldn't he be told, Dad, look, he's not dead, we've sold him into slavery? Or why couldn't the brothers go down to Egypt and get him back again? Later on they do that quite a number of times. You know, it's very difficult to see someone crying who's lost a son. Unless it's happened to you, you don't understand. It feels as though your heart's been poured out. And you cry all day. You get up in the morning, and Jacob would think the very first thought, Joseph's gone. And he would cry all day. And at night, he would cry himself to sleep. My dearly beloved Joseph has gone. And the brothers witnessed this for days, for weeks, for months, and not one of them say a thing. Then it totally changes. We've got in chapter 37 and at verse 35, Jacob crying his eyes out, and there's an enormous contrast in chapter 38 to Judah. You know, sometimes when we read chapter 38, we read it very quickly, and we hope our children don't ask any embarrassing questions. Right, let's get back into chapter 39. Right, let's get into it. Why is chapter 38 there? It's a disgusting chapter. Genesis is about the story of Joseph. We understand that. But interwoven into that story is the change that occurs in the brethren. And chapter 38 focuses particularly on Judah because he is the worst of the brethren. He's got his dad at home crying his eyes out. And he says, I've had enough of this. I am now going in chapter 38 and verse 1 to visit the Canaanites. Joseph's gone. I will no doubt become the firstborn. I will get more money than anyone else. I'm not going to spend time at home. I'm going to spend time with the important people in Canaan. And that's exactly what he did. He spends time with a certain Adullamite. Strong says that's a prominent Adullamite. And while he's there, he sees this beautiful Canaanite. I'll marry her. Even though Abraham said to his grandchildren, don't do it. Even though Esau left the truth because of it, I don't care. And in verse 3, she conceived and bare a son and called his name Ur. She conceived again and bare a son and called his name Onan. And she conceived again in verse 5. They hoped that they were going to have a girl, but they end up having a boy, but they still called him Shelah. Now, you got that joke. I told that joke because I was sure Americans would not get that. That is our special term for a girl. How dare you laugh at that? You know, it's pretty serious. Who is the first person of whom it is specifically told us that Yahweh killed him? The first person in Scripture of whom it says, and the Lord killed him. Who was it? Ur. Who was the second son of whom it specifically says that Yahweh killed him? Onan. Can you imagine the spirituality in the house that would produce boys like this? And it gets worse. In verse 14, Judah commits fornication with Tamar, his daughter-in-law. Is he embarrassed? No, in verse 14, it occurs in an open place, a public place. Here's someone who has no shame whatsoever with immorality. The eighth point. I don't care if people see me. What's the problem? Now, in verse 24, after 3 months, it's told Judah, Tamar has played the harlot. Judah's furious. Bring her forth. We can't tolerate that sort of thing in the ecclesia. Let's burn her alive. Verse 25, she's brought forth. She's charged by the courts. It's almost at the point of when she's going to receive the death sentence and she says, actually, I know who the father is. It's Judah. And in verse 26, Judah acknowledged and said, she's been more righteous than I because I didn't give them Shelah, my son. You might think, well, there's a slight sign of spirituality, but brothers and sisters, he does not change at all. Look at all these problems that Judah has got. If it was us, we'd say, look, he's gone. Used to be a tremendous brother, but I think the case is hopeless. But what does God do? You know, our God is amazing. Here is a person who is the lowest of all people, but God still works. He works really, really hard to turn him around. And brothers and sisters, that is a very powerful point for us. People who've left the truth, we should act as God does to them. God does not give up, and neither should we. And I think if there's nothing else we learn from this morning, is I think it's important. Write a list of people who've left the truth that you knew full well and keep in regular contact. Why? Because if God's still working with them, he'll bring difficulties upon them that will cause them to come back to the truth. And if they've got someone, a brother or sister, who've been in regular contact with them, they've got a greater chance of coming back to the truth. And God works with him. Does he ever come across to Genesis 41, verse 53? There is now 7 years of plenteousness in the land of Israel. It's unheard of, prosperity. And while Judah is going through prosperity, he will never change. Plenty of money. He's spending time with his Canaanite friends. But then in verse 54, there's 7 years of dearth, not just in Egypt, but in all lands. 7 years of hunger and famine. Verse 55, it says there, when all the land of Egypt and all the lands around were famished. That word means voraciously hungry. Brothers and sisters, the famine is absolutely vital. Until the famine came, Judah will not change. Of course, we know the famine was part of God's providence to get the people of Israel to go down to Egypt to increase, but it's also part of the care and love of God to change all of the brethren, but particularly to change Judah. And God puts the pressure on even more. The end of verse 56, the famine seizes hold upon them. And when Jacob saw there was no corn in Egypt, he says to his boys, don't stare at each other, go and buy corn. Now notice what verse 3 says of chapter 42. Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn. It's indicating the start of a change where Joseph and his brothers are going to be reconciled together. And they come there in verse 6 to the ruler of the land. They've got no idea it's Joseph. They think it is this Egyptian called Zaphnath-Paaneah. And fulfilling the dream, they came and bowed themselves with their faces to the earth. Joseph saw his brethren. Why? Because he'd been looking for them for many long years. He knew them and he made himself strange unto them. That means he made himself a foreigner. So he looks like an Egyptian. He's dressed in Egyptian clothes, he's got the mannerisms of an Egyptian, who knows what that is, and he speaks the Egyptian language. But more than that, he speaks roughly. Now you wonder why. What does that mean, roughly? He speaks severely, he speaks harshly, he speaks fiercely too. You know, it's interesting to read the church commentators. They say this is shocking what Joseph is doing. He's playing games with his brethren. Why doesn't he tell them who he is at the first meeting? Some go even further and they say Joseph is seeking revenge. Brothers and sisters, that's absolute nonsense. What we've got here is a beautiful record, because what Joseph does here gives us an indication of how God changes us when we have a problem. So therefore, Joseph represents the attitude of God and what God does to change us. Whereas Judah represents the attitude we have to have if God is going to accept us. And part of repentance, before we can change, the vital thing that we need before any of us can change is repentance. And what's repentance? It is sorrow. When we look to the past and we are determined to change. And the only way we can have sorrow is if we realise what we've done. And that's exactly what Joseph has to do. The very first step is to get these boys to realise what they have done. Now the very first thing he says to them in verse 9 is he says, you are spies, you're come to see whether or not the land is defended. You've come from Israel and you are planning an invasion. Why does he say that? So that Judah can say, we are not spies. In actual fact, we're true men, he says in verse 11. That's worth underlining. You know, it's virtually out of his mouth when he thinks, hang on, I'm standing here before the ruler of Egypt saying I'm a true man, but I'm a really true. Am I really sincere and upright and honest? Or have I been living a lie for the last 20 years? He comes back again. No, you've come to see how undefended the land is in verse 12. And they come up with a good answer. Look, if we're spies, why would a father send 10 brothers? And Joseph basically says, I don't believe a thing you say. Verse 15, I want you to prove it. You are not honest men. He puts them in prison. He locks them up in prison for 3 days. Why? You need to understand how your sin has hurt other people. Remember, you lock someone else up in a prison, in a cistern. But then in verse 18, after locking them up for 3 days, he totally changes. And he says to them, this do and live, for I fear Elohim. And Judah is amazed. How does this Egyptian, Zaphnath-Paaneah, know of our family's special name for God?
Then he has compassion and he says, I'll only take one of your brethren, take corn for your house and go home, but bring back your younger brother. Why?
See the issue? He's trying to change them. Verse 19, are you true men?
You know, for the last 20 years, you brethren have been living a lie. And if you're going to change, you need to realise what you've done.
You men are not true men. You've got to acknowledge your problem and seek forgiveness. You know what? It's starting to work. They say we are guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and he would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. That is a very interesting verse. You would imagine they'd say, look, our big problem is that we've sold our brother into slavery. But they don't say that. They say the worst sin that we committed is when we're eating our lunch and Joseph was pleading with his life. The worst sin that we have committed is we had no pity.
You know, isn't that interesting? Later on, David would commit the sin of adultery and murder. But by his own admission, he realises that the worst of all his sins, in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and at verse 6, is that I had no pity.
And the brethren are starting to develop this sort of spirituality because we didn't have this pity in verse 21. Therefore, the distress is come upon us.
Well, the boys are very relieved when finally they go home. But in verse 27, one of them opened his sack. Oh, it would have been highly appropriate if that was Judah. Joseph deliberately put this bag full of money to highlight another one of Judah's problems, the love of money. He went back home to his father, missing a brother, and he had in his pocket a sack full of money that wasn't his. What's Joseph doing? Go back to when you sinned 20 years ago. Because 20 years ago, you went back to your father, missing a brother, and with a pocket full of money that was not yours.
You need to go back to your sin to realise your sin, acknowledge your sin, and realise how your sin has hurt other people.
And he said to his brethren in verse 28, my money is restored, it's in the sack. And their heart failed them, and they were shuddering with terror, and they said, what is God doing to us?
Can you see what's happening, brethren and sisters? They are starting to develop the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom.
They come back and tell their father, and in particular they tell their father that we can't, in verse 34, go back to Egypt unless our younger brother is with us. Look at the reaction of Joseph. Have a look in verse. I've lost my place. That's the trouble with this fan. Just relax, everyone. Just talk among yourselves. Look at the reaction in verse. Simply because I paused, I've got two people walking out. I'm really, really sorry. It'll be a lot smoother now. It'll be seamless now, I can promise you. Verse 36, and Jacob, when he hears that next time they've got to take Benjamin down to Egypt, Jacob says unto them in verse 36, me have ye bereaved of children, Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away, all these things are against me. Can you imagine how Judah would feel? For the very first time, in effect, Jacob accuses the boys that you have killed Joseph. Oh yes, it could have been fear. It could have been worry. It could have been frustration.
The boys thought Dad was totally fooled. But they start to think, did Dad have an inkling of what actually occurred? And he says, these things are against me. I've got to bear the burden alone because your comfort means nothing. He could see that the boys weren't genuine. Verse 38, my son will not go down with any of you. His brother's dead. You can imagine him looking Judah straight in the eye.
I'm suspicious. And he is left alone. If mischief befall him, and again, more suspicion, I wonder if mischief befell Joseph. If this happens to Benjamin when you go down, then you'll bring down my grey hair with sorrow to the grave. And you can see all of this is designed by God to work upon their conscience. They thought their father was totally fooled, but Dad says, if I lose Benjamin, it's going to kill me. Does God let up? No, the next chapter, the famine gets worse. They eat up all the corn in verse 2, and Dad says, go and get us some more food. Notice again, verse 3, it is Judah taking the lead. And he says to Dad, look, I know you don't want us to take Benjamin, but if we stay here, we're going to die anyway. We're better to go down to Egypt. Our chances of survival, including Benjamin's chances of survival, will be higher than dying here through lack of food. The verse I'm about to read to you, you'll find difficult to believe that it comes from the lips of Judah. Dad, I will be surety for him. Of my hand shalt thou require him. If I bring him not unto thee and set him before thee, then let me bear the blame forever. And I think that's worth underlining. What is it saying? Surely it's saying that if I don't bring Benjamin back, then I will bear the blame forever. In other words, I am prepared to give up my place in the kingdom if Benjamin doesn't come back. And they make their way to Egypt. They end up in the palace of Joseph. Verse 27, the very first word he says to his brethren, he asked of their welfare, and literally he said to them, Shalom. Is your father? Shalom. And they say in verse 28, our father is in good health, he is alive, and again they bow down before him. We know the story from Sunday school. You've got a table for Joseph, a table for the Egyptians, and a table for the brothers who are now old men. They're in the exact order of age. But then Joseph does something very unusual in verse 34. He gives all of the brethren messes, which was a delicate food or a gift, but he gives Benjamin five times as much. Why? The root cause of their problem was envy and jealousy when one of the brethren received special care and love. Now he's doing it again. Brethren, I'm going to show special care and love to Benjamin. How are you going to react? Well, verse 3, they go home. And I think Judah was a very relieved man when he goes back home again with plenty of food, with Benjamin and with Simeon. Now we all know the story. Joseph deliberately puts a cup in the sack. Why? Is he playing games? No, no, no. This is the final test to see whether or not the brethren have changed. Are you going to abandon one of the 12 brothers? And it's one of you who receives special treatment. You can picture how Judah would feel when he hears soldiers behind them. They accuse them of stealing the cup of Joseph. Judah is horrified and he says in verse 9, with whomsoever of thy servants be found, both let him die and we will be thy Lord's bondmen. And they search and they can't believe out of Benjamin's sack comes this gleaming cup and they rip their clothes. And notice what it says in verse 14. It's worth underlining, then Judah and his brethren. Again, he takes the lead and his brethren are with him. All of them agree, look, brethren, you can imagine them discussing it. We've got to do anything to stop our father going through the grief that he went through. They throw themselves onto the ground. And Joseph is deliberately high-handed and dictatorial. What have you done? Don't you know I can divine? And Judah says, what shall we say to my Lord? What shall we speak? How will we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of thy servants. We are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. Can you see this confession? Brothers and sisters, if you have a problem,
You need to acknowledge your problem and confess it before God without excuses. Don't blame everyone else. Don't blame your brethren. Don't blame your father and mother. It is your problem. And bluntly and honestly, he says, I have sinned before God. Oh, I've hurt Joseph. I've hurt Jacob. But above all, my sin has hurt my God. You can see what's happened. No longer is he living a lie. Now look, verse 17 is very interesting. You can picture the scene. In verse 15, Joseph has been very angry. But now his tone noticeably changes. God forbid that you all should be servants. I only want the man in whose cup the cup has been found. He's the only one who I want to be my servant. The rest of you, go home in peace with plenty of food, no problem. Oh, what a test. Here they are in a foreign country. They're in Egypt of all places. I don't know if you've been to Egypt. It's not a very nice place. You can't wait to get out of there. We can go if we leave Benjamin behind. You know, Joseph, if he revealed himself at the first meeting, the brethren would not have reacted in the right way. They probably would have lied. But given time, they are now ready for the final test. All of you can save yourselves if you leave Benjamin behind. And there's even more reason to leave Benjamin behind. It seems everyone shows special love and attention to Benjamin. Your dad does it, and even this Zaphnath Paaneah shows love to him. Let's leave him. That family, the family of Rachel, always cause problems. Let's leave him and let's go back home. And we've got plenty of food, not just for us, but also for our families. Look what we've got in verse 18. Judah comes near. He takes full responsibility, and what we're going to see here, brothers and sisters, is one of the greatest pleadings ever on behalf of his brothers. It is brilliant. First of all, respect. Oh my Lord, do you mind if I talk to you? And then he fills him in with the background. Verse 18, my Lord did ask his servants, saying, have you got a father or a brother? And we said, we have a father, an old man, a child of his old age, a little one, and his brother is dead, and he alone is left of his mother, and his father dearly loves him. What a change. The root cause has been envy and jealousy, but now he is willing to accept the fact that Benjamin is loved far more than all of the other brethren. Can you see what's happened to Judah? He's developed the accepting attitude of Leah. Up until this stage, he said, no, Dad must not show special love to anyone else. But now he accepts it. Dad loved Benjamin and Dad loved Joseph. I can live with that. But look at verse 30. He's pleading with Zaphnath-Paaneah. And he says, now therefore, when I come to thy servant my father, and the lad is not with us, his life is bound up in the lad's life. It will come to pass when he sees that the lad is not with us, it will kill him. And thy servants will have brought down the grey hairs of our father with sorrow to the grave. Can you believe this is the same Judah who sat down in gross hypocrisy and pretended to comfort his father? He says, look, it's our fault. If we go back without our little brother, it's going to kill my dad. It's not your fault, Zaphnath-Paaneah. He clearly says in verse 31, thy servants will bring down our father to the grave. It's our fault. But please, show mercy, not to us, we don't deserve it, but show mercy to an old, grief stricken, broken-hearted dad who's already lost one of his boys. And Joseph is just so amazed. Trial has just totally changed Judah. He is so thoughtful and considerate. And now he hears for the very first time what Judah has offered to his dad to allow Benjamin to come in the first place. I'd offered to become surety to my father for the lad, saying,
if I bring him not unto thee, then I'll bear the blame to my father forever. Joseph is amazed as he hears this offer. What a tremendous offer. There's very few people in Scripture. Moses is one that I can think of who is prepared to give up his own place in the kingdom for his brethren. But more than that, verse 33, I'm pleading with you, let thy servant stay here instead of Benjamin. Please let me be a bondman to my Lord and let the lad go up with his brethren. He's pleading. Can I please be a servant to you? I'm prepared to scrub Egyptian kitchen floors and toilets until I drop dead so Benjamin can go home. And then the final thing, verse 34. How can I go up to my father and Benjamin be not with me? I just can't see the evil coming upon my dad all over again. What would drive someone to give up their place in the kingdom? What would drive someone to say, I'm going to work 20 hours a day as a slave until I drop dead? Why? Because I don't want evil to come on my father. If I go back home without Benjamin, it will kill my dad. I've hurt my dad too much. I've seen my dad in tears for year after year after year. I just can't do it to Dad. Please, let me stay here with you. And Joseph could not restrain himself. That's why in chapter 45 and at verse 1, the tears just pour out. He's crying aloud. They shut the doors and they can still hear him outside. Why is he crying? Why has this eruption of tears happened to Joseph? Because of the change in his brethren, but particularly the change in Joseph, in Judah. And Judah is wondering, what on earth is going on with this Zaphnath-Paaneah? He's angry one minute, then kind, then suspicious, then he's got this uncanny insight. He's generous, and now he's crying his eyes out in Egyptian. What on earth is going on? Joseph looks him straight in the eye. Up until now, the whole conversation had not been directed straight to the brethren. It had been through translators. But now he looks him in the eye and he speaks in Hebrew. I am Joseph. And in verse 3, the brethren are speechless and they are terrified at his presence. And Joseph says, come near. They shrunk away in fear, shame and embarrassment. They're wondering what's going on. They are confused. Can this Egyptian be our little brother Joseph? You sold me into Egypt. There's only 11 people who knew this. And they realized it must be him. And when they hear this, when they are convinced that this is Joseph, in verse 5, they are grieved. It means they are tortured. Can you see what's happening? They have sorrow when they realize what they have done. Not only are they tortured, they are furious with themselves. And that's the tipping point. They've come to acknowledge their sin. They've come to realize their sin. They've come to realize how much they've hurt their God. They confess their sins publicly before people. And what does Joseph do? He doesn't get stuck into them and tell them what they've done and how much they've hurt. They realize that already. He forgives them. And that's exactly what God does when we come before him and say, God, I now realize what I've done. How I've hurt myself. I've hurt other people. I've hurt you. Please forgive me. God forgives us and then he comforts us. And that's exactly what Joseph does. He comforts them and he says, look, I know you're upset. I know you feel tortured. I know you are furious with yourself. But in verse 5, you sold me, but God has sent me to preserve life. Okay, you didn't do the right thing, but God has made the most of it. Verse 7, he has sent me before you to preserve a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. And then in verse 14, He fell first of all upon his brother Benjamin's neck, and he wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. And then he kisses all his brethren, including the ringleader, who was Judah. And after that, his brethren talked with him. Once upon a time, they even refused to say shalom. We would have loved to have been there and heard what was said. First of all, they would have said, I just can't express how sorry I am for what I have done. And we're trying to understand what you went through and the pain that you and Dad felt. But now we are so thankful. We are filled with appreciation for your incredible forgiveness and love. You know, before the end of the day, Judah did something that he had not done for 20 years. He went to his father in prayer. And the attitude of Joseph showed God's attitude to him. If you're prepared to change, God will totally accept you and restore you to friendship. And that's exactly what Judah did. He went to God and said, I acknowledge my sin. He begged for forgiveness in tears, and brothers and sisters, he was convinced that God forgave him and restored him to favour. Why? Because he saw it in the face of his dear brother, Joseph.